Everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Natural Health Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on tax protest when we come back. You know, if you were going to buy something, say a motorcycle, for $1,600, and you go out and you earn $1,600 and then pay your tax, that's your income tax, 25% of that in round numbers, your tax would be $400, and you'd be left with $1,200 to go out and buy that motorcycle. So you can't buy a $1,600 motorcycle. You can only buy a $1,200 motorcycle after you've earned $1,600. But what about the guy who sells you the motorcycle for $1,200? Well, he has to pay a 25% tax. That's $300, and that leaves him with $900. And then he goes out and he wants to buy something. So he goes out and buys food or groceries or something like that. And the guy that takes the money from him takes $675 and pays his 25% tax. And each and every person in the chain, as the money filters through the economy and everybody is paying their taxes, by the time that $1,600 has gone through 10 transactions, the government has 95% of it out of $1,600. 95% of it in 10 transactions goes to the government in taxes. Now, you talk about a business. That is the greatest business adventure that anybody has ever dreamed of. Better than banking. Better than insurance. The government has 95% of the $1,600 in just 10 transactions. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. And remember, tax and status, the school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about tax protest. I pointed out to you the tax protest got started in this country with A.J. Porth in a modern form, its modern manifestation, back in 1944. By 1965, it had assumed a life of its own. And from 1965 to 1985, tax protest was in vogue. This is during the period of the Vietnam War, by the way. And people stopped paying their taxes. That was unheard of in America. Americans had always paid their taxes. But during this period of time, about one-third of Americans stopped paying their taxes. And by 1985, Roscoe Eggers, the commissioner of the IRS, he reported that on July 9th, in a speech that he was giving in Las Vegas, Nevada, that by July 9th, 1985, one-third of the taxpayers of America had not filed their tax returns. And when I saw that back in 1985, I was absolutely shocked. I said, wow, it's the same. I just saw it in the International Forecaster the other day. One-third of American taxpayers are not filing and paying their taxes. Now, it's estimated that if they would, there wouldn't be any budget deficit. So if you want to know why we have a $300-500 billion a year budget deficit, it's because one-third of the taxpayers aren't paying their taxes. That, of course, leaves a higher burden on the two-thirds that are paying their taxes. And, of course, those people are all fudging, too. Everybody does it. Maybe not everybody, but most people will fudge. For instance, when you go out and rototill your neighbor's garden over there and he pays you $25, did you report that dutifully on your tax return as $25 of income and pay $5 or $7 or $9 of that over in income tax? Or did you just forget about that under-the-counter cash transaction? Or that skimming, as they would call it in certain occupations. And then, of course, we've got the farmers out here. They want government solutions to their problems in life. And then, of course, we all want highway patrolmen out on the highways to make the roads safe for us to travel on. And, of course, that costs money. You got to pay those guys for doing that, you know. And then, of course, the veterans, when they come home from the wars, they feel that they have done their share for America, and they want some special benefits like veterans benefits. Government workers want retirement at the end of their 20 or 30 years of service to the government. It seems like here in America, everybody has his hand out to the government, wanting the government to pay them some money. Social Security recipients want a guaranteed income after they retire. So we have to have a Social Security Administration, a Veterans Administration, a Department of Agriculture. We have to have a Park Service, All of those things cost money, boys and girls. And in the olden days, when our founding fathers created our nation back in 1787, they didn't provide for the Highway Patrol. They didn't provide for the Veterans Administration. They didn't provide for the Department of Agriculture. They didn't believe that we needed those amenities. So they didn't provide for them. And we had a more limited government. But as time progressed, we, the Americans, decided little by little, not all at the same time, certainly, but little by little, that we needed these amenities. So back in the 1860s, President Lincoln decided that we needed a Department of Agriculture to help the farmers. And so that was good for the farmers, and now we have a Department of Agriculture. The Department of Agriculture spends more money on their personnel in the operation than they do on the farmers. It's a bloated bureaucracy, and all bureaucracies become bloated over time. If you take a look at school administration as an illustration, one-third of all of the money that we spend on public schools goes to administration. One-third. 33 cents out of every dollar goes to administering the program. Cost of doing business, cost of goods sold, as we would say in the business world. Two-thirds of it, of course, goes to the classroom, goes to the teachers, goes to buying books and classrooms and heating the classrooms and all the things that we need. But always remember, one-third of it now goes to a bloated bureaucracy. If we could get rid of that bloated bureaucracy, take a look at the income tax as an illustration. In 1995, it cost Americans 15 cents out of every dollar of tax that they paid to administer the program. By the year 2005, it was up to 22 cents. Now think of that. Think of that. For every dollar that our federal government collects, it costs you and I 22 cents in addition to that, to administer that. I remember when I was running a small corporation out in Boise, Idaho, we had a budget for our office, the office budget in the company, and we spent 25% of our company's revenue on government administration. 25%. Went just to figuring out the taxes, paying accountants and paying lawyers and all of the things that go to filling out the forms for those 28 agencies of government that we had to deal with between Boise, Idaho and Washington, D.C. So I'm somewhat familiar with the bloated government bureaucracy. And of course, the more burden you place on fewer people, then the more dissatisfied they become. You can rest assured that as the two-thirds who are shouldering the tax burden today look at the one-third who are not shouldering their tax burden, more and more of the two-thirds are going to stop paying the tax, which makes an even bigger burden on those that are left until finally the whole thing collapses. And then there has to be a new starting point. Sometimes it's called revolution. Sometimes it's just an economic collapse. Sometimes it's a reorganization, a new administration, as they had down in Argentina. They just went through this in Argentina in 2001. We Americans are about to go through it, and I think that you Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders are going to follow right along. In fact, I think the entire world economy is on the cusp of meltdown. And when it occurs, there's going to be some kind of a new regime worldwide. And the people who are in power call it the New World Order. They've got a plan, they have an agenda, and they want to impose it around the world. Bible prophecy talks about it also. The Bible talks about it and calls it the Great Tribulation, a period of time that lasts 3.5 years, which is described in Matthew chapter 24 as the worst period of time in the history of the world. It will outshine Noah's flood. For the sheer destruction and loss of life, it will outclass Noah's flood. Now, you got that right from Jesus himself. Now, when we talk about tax protest Evan by itself, I pointed out that it's a ticket for jail. Irwin Schiff is a name that most tax protesters would readily identify with or recognize. And I mentioned how Irwin has been to jail now 3 times, if not 4, that I know of, maybe more than that or so, but I've known of 3 times that he's gone to jail in his efforts to reform the tax system, the IRS and the Federal Reserve. One thing about tax protesters that I've observed over the years is that these are people with a mission. It's almost like an evangelistic mission. It's religious in nature. There's a wrong going on, and we need to correct it. Good people, most of them that I've discovered, or most of them that I've run into. Oh, there's a few charlatans and a few profit takers here and there. But by and large, most of them are well-meaning people, and they're hardworking people. They're mainly laboring people who want to keep more of what they work for themselves. Now, I don't know if you've paid attention to what your tax burden is. In my tax school, I take people through the 14 taxes, and I show them what the percentages are. Now, not everybody pays all 14 taxes. But you know, it isn't impossible for you to be paying all 14 of those taxes. For instance, property tax. It's a tax that all of us who own property pay. The people that don't own property, of course, don't pay the property tax. So if you're renting an apartment, you're paying a property tax, but you're just paying it for somebody else. It's rolled right into your rent payment. So you're paying property tax whether you know it or not. You'd have to be living under a bridge not to be paying property tax. And then there's the gasoline tax. Well, maybe you don't drive a car, but you know, every time you ride a bus, you're paying the gasoline tax. Every time you take a trip where somebody's burning motor fuel, you're paying the gasoline tax. And in our state, it's 40 cents a gallon. And in some states, it's near 50 cents a gallon, both federal and state. Now, there's capital gains tax, and there's income tax, and Social Security tax, unemployment tax, and Medicare tax. And you know, you add all these taxes up. Some cities have a tax, like San Francisco, California. San Francisco taxes their residents with an income tax. So you can have city income tax, state income tax, federal income tax, property tax, capital gains tax, motor fuel tax, unemployment tax, Medicare tax. And then there are some other less obvious taxes, like fines that you pay when you don't pay your tax on time, and assessments that come up, and license fees or taxes, and you have to have a business license to operate your business, and so on down the line. You add all those taxes up, and how much does your government's federal, state, and local take from you? You know, the average guy on the street doesn't pay much attention to the total tax bite. He gets little snippets of what the tax bite costs. He may look at the motor fuel pump where it says his state tax and federal tax is 17 cents and 23 cents and add it up and say, wow, I'm paying $2 a gallon for gas and 40 cents of that is tax. So the real price of the gas is $1.60 a gallon. I want to point out a little something to you here. In 1950, the average price of gasoline nationwide was 27.4 cents. In round numbers, we'll just call it 30 cents a gallon. 30 cents. Well, inflation from 1950 to 2000 has gone up by 10 times, a magnitude of 10. So the price of gasoline at $3 a gallon today is the same price as 30 cents a gallon back in 1950. So if you're paying something under $3 a gallon for gasoline, it's a better value than it was back in 1950. I can remember telephones. Back in World War II, we'd call my Uncle Carol, who was in the Air Force down in Orlando, Florida, and you got to talk on the telephone for 3 minutes. You'd place a call, and the call would take about 20 or 30 minutes to make. You call the operator, give her the number. She'd call you back when she got the line through, and you could talk to your Uncle Carol for 3 minutes, and I mean it was 3 minutes, and at the end of 3 minutes, they cut you off. And it cost $2 and some change. I think it was about 74 or 5 cents change, about $3.75 for 3 minutes. That's more than a dollar a minute, and that's in 1944. Today, it costs about 5 cents a minute. I know I can make a radio program, 60-minute radio program, for 5 cents a minute, $3. It costs less for an hour of telephone time today than it did back in 1944 for 3 minutes, and it's a lot better service. So we're actually, in many, many ways, better off today than we were back in the 1940s, and in many ways, we're even poorer than we were. For instance, my dad supported his family on one income. Back in 1955, it wasn't necessary for mom to work. In fact, when I was growing up, if a woman was working outside the home, it was a shame. That man couldn't support his family. Think of that. Today, half the women in America are in the workforce. Half. I guess it's woman's lib. And of course, all of this takes a toll, because when you don't have a two-parent family, you have more juvenile delinquency. Juvenile delinquency then causes crime. Crime then requires more policemen and more people on the street in the form of probation officers and juvenile homes and so on to take care of these added costs that go into the governmental operation. So whether it's state, federal, or local, you've got to have tax collectors. Somebody has to physically go out and take the money away from you and then give it to that farmer. Somebody has to take the money away from that farmer and give it to that veteran. You got to hire somebody to take that money away from that veteran and give it to that highway patrolman. And so that's what distraint is all about. And that's why, while our system is called a voluntary system, the reality of it is, once you've volunteered and you have your taxpayer status, and once you're earning income, once you divorce yourself from property and get into commerce, you become a taxpayer and you have to pay your fair share. And if you don't, then somebody's going to punish you. They're going to do something nasty to you, like take your house away from you, or put a lien on your property, or they're going to take part of your paycheck every week, or they're going to put you in jail, maybe. It gets down to that. Now, the tax protesters run a risk, but it's not all that great a risk. That one-third of Americans who aren't filing and paying their taxes are actually pretty safe, because the federal government can only prosecute about 20,000 cases a year. Last time I saw it was 18,000. So around 20,000 cases a year out of 30 to 35 million people. Those are pretty good odds, I'd say. And in addition to that, you've got the state tax commission. They're out after a certain number of people. But again, if you talk about a crime that pays, tax evasion or willful failure to file are right up there in the top 400. But there are a certain number of people that get caught and a certain number of people that run the risk of losing their property if they participate in the tax protest movement. So let's take a look at a few more of these willful failure to file. The most common method used by tax protesters is to simply not file a return, or to file a return that reports no financial information and may espouse tax protest rhetoric. Generally, withholding of income taxes by employers is also prevented. So what constitutes a return? Well, a Form 1040 must contain information relating to the taxpayer's income from which a tax can be computed to satisfy the requirements of the Internal Revenue Code. The Form 1040 filed in Porth and Daly contained only the taxpayers' names and addresses, references to various constitutional provisions which assertedly excused them from filing tax returns. Failure to file convictions in both cases were upheld, and the court in the A.J. Porth case said the return filed was completely devoid of information concerning his income as required by the regulations of the IRS. A taxpayer's return which does not contain any information relating to the taxpayer's income from which the tax can be computed is not a return within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code or the regulations adopted by the commissioner. In United States versus Schiff, there's also a story on willfulness. So, A.J. Porth, Daly, Schiff, Porth, you know, these are the early tax protesters that have big names who have been convicted, who were out teaching tax protest to others, writing books and periodicals and papers and spreading the word. And indeed, they've had a gigantic effect on the tax system of America. In fact, the very reason that you have a deficit is because of these A.J. Porths and Schiffs and others who have encouraged people to protest this tax. So ultimately, when the history of this is written, you know, in the year 2100 or 2200, and you look back in history, like we look back at the Declaration of Independence or look back on the Constitution of the United States, there are events that, while they're contemporary in our time, and we don't see the ultimate end or the end game of this process, historians will look back 100 or 200 years from now and they'll say, wow, that guy A.J. Porth and Schiff and Daly and these tax protesters had a very pronounced effect on the decline and fall of the great American empire. Now, the test in willful failure to file is whether the defendant's returns themselves furnished the required information for the IRS to make the computation and the assessment, not whether the information was available somewhere else. Form 1040, which report only zeros, are not valid returns. And when it's apparent that the defendant is not attempting to file forms accurately disclosing his income, he may be charged with failure to file a return. And in United States versus Long, zeros on Long's tax forms, unlike blanks, constituted information as to income from which a tax could be computed, just as if the return had contained other numbers. So, if we want to call this success, we found out that when you file a return, sign it, fill in your name and address, but don't provide any information, that gets you prosecuted for willful failure to file. But if you fill in zeros all the way down, that constitutes a return. Similarly, courts have held the tax forms reporting nothing or small amounts in the blanks provided for income and expenses do not constitute legal returns within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code. Total income figure based on his interpretation of constitutional dollars and a blanket claim of Fifth Amendment as to all other items. So conviction was upheld where the returns only reported asterisks. And the Form 1040 with the word object written in all of the spaces requesting information is not a return. And unknown or claimed Fifth Amendment responses on Forms 1040 do not constitute returns either. A Form 1040 that shows only a bottom line figure for taxable income with no information as to how that reported taxable income was derived, such as the source of the income and the amount of gross income and the deductions and the number of exemptions claimed, is not a valid income tax return as a matter of law. The rule is one of reason. Thus, the Grabensky court stated that, on the other hand, omission of isolated information not seriously hampering the IRS's ability to check a taxpayer's asserted tax liability, for example, the omission of a taxpayer's social security number or the non-disclosure of the names of one's dependent children, does not invalidate a return under Section 7203. Now, when you compare Grabensky and United States versus Crowhurst, in which the defendant filed Forms 1040, which were blank, except for the defendant's signature and a request for a refund of income tax, which was withheld and then attached to Form W-2. The Ninth Circuit held that the Form 1040 with the attached W-2s did in fact constitute returns because they provided the IRS with ostensibly complete information from which a tax could be computed. And they upheld the defendant's conviction under Section 7206 for filing false returns in the Crowhurst case. So you run two risks. If you don't file a return, you could be prosecuted for willful failure to file. And if you do file a return and you put in bad information, you could be prosecuted for tax evasion, which is a felony, and that's worse. Did it ever occur to us that perhaps this income tax on income wasn't as good an idea as we originally thought it was? Kind of like the war in Iraq. Sounded like a pretty good idea at the time, but, you know, 2 or 3 years later, we look at the war in Iraq, and now we're starting to have some second thoughts, at least some of us are, and maybe it wasn't as good an idea as we originally thought. Back in olden times, back about, you know, 1000 B.C., there was a story in the Bible. You want to read this because it's pretty humorous. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel is a book in the Bible, and for some of you that are biblical illiterates, it's up around the 10th book or so. You know, you got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. There's your first five. And then you got Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. And then you get 1 and 2 Samuel. Well, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, kind of early on, Moses is dead. You know, the people have entered into the promised land. And the people came to Samuel, who was the chief judge, and they said, "We want a king like all the nations around us." And it sounded like such a good idea. I mean, everybody else around them had kings, and they thought, well, gosh, if we had a king, that'd be a pretty good idea. We could kind of blend in. It's kind of like democracy today. You know, democracy is the in form of government. Sounds like such a good idea. We have democracy here in America, and so we think that the Iraqis ought to have democracy, and the Saudis, and the Iranians. In fact, we're so excited about democracy, we Americans are like evangelists. We're just going out all over the world trying to promote democracy everywhere. Well, you know, back in those days, monarchy seemed to be the big in thing, and the people of Israel, our ancient forefathers, they wanted a king like all the nations around us. And so they went to Samuel and said, "Hey, we want a king." Samuel went to God, went to the God of Abraham, not the normal, ordinary, run-of-the-mill Mardi Gras God. I'm talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Passover, Feast of Tabernacles God, the different God, the other God. Well, you know, Samuel went to God, and he said, "Now listen, these people over here want a king. They're not satisfied with this government that we have, that you've imposed upon us, this government of God. They're not satisfied with that. They want a government with a king. They want a physical head over here." So God was a little bummed out about that, and he said, "Well, Sam, you run over to these people and you tell them the story for me." This chapter now is only 22 verses. You can read it in 10 or 15 minutes if you're as slow as I am. And he said, "You better warn these people that they're making a big mistake." You know, back in 1913, I'm sure that this income tax sounded like a pretty good idea. I'm sure that government officials were running around saying, "My God, do you know how much money that Henry Ford is making?" In 1930, I remember they complained about Henry Ford. Did you know that Henry Ford made $30 million in 1930? God, that was the catalyst for Social Security. Henry Ford made $30 million in 1930. They complained about Babe Ruth, too, but Babe said he had a better year than the president when they said to him, "Do you know, Babe, you made more money than the president of the United States?" And Babe Ruth said, "Yeah, but I had a better year." Well, anyway, it sounds like a good idea. Social Security sounded like a good idea. I'm sure that the Federal Reserve sounded like a good idea. And I'm sure that the income tax sounded like a real good idea, just like the war in Iraq sounded like just a hell of an idea. Well, back there about Samuel's time in 1000 B.C., the idea of having a monarch, a king, sounded like a real good idea. And so God warned us at that time. He said, "Now listen, boys and girls, gather around, you little grasshoppers, and let me tell you how this deal is going to come down." He said, "The day is going to come when this king that you set over you is going to tax you until it hurts so bad that you're going to cry out to me. You are going to cry out to God. You are going to get prayers and get real religious. And you're going to pray to me to give you relief. And when you do that, I'm not going to hear you." That's about verse 19. 1 Samuel, you got to read this. 1 Samuel, you tell me that God doesn't have a sense of humor. I mean, this guy's got a real sense of humor. And he said, when this deal comes down, he said, "You don't need to waste your time praying to me because I'm not going to hear that crap." Well, stand by here and let me give you a reminder, and we'll be back with more on tax protest when we return. In the meantime, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, they're religious, racial, ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review in every case. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, remember, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about tax protest and tax protesters. By the way, I mentioned this earlier, I'll mention it again. The first tax protester in history, at least in Anglo-Saxon administration, was a guy by the name of Gideon. You can read about him in the book of Judges. Gideon, tax protester withholding his taxes. So tax protest isn't something new that just came about, you know, in the Clinton administration or the Bush administration. It's been with us for at least 3,000 or 4,000 years. At least in America, with the Anglo-Saxons derived or descended from Manasseh. All right, the determination of whether a return is valid for Section 7203 purposes is a question of law for the court to decide. So it's not a question of fact that the jury decides. A lot of times people say, well, I want a jury trial. Well, okay, you can have a jury trial, and the jury is going to decide whether or not you filed and paid your taxes. They're not going to decide whether or not, as a matter of law, you needed to file a tax return. So a lot of times people get it in their minds that if they can just get this message out to the jury, everything's going to be all right. Well, under the rules of court, you can't get your message to the jury. Now, I don't know if that's right or wrong or good or bad. I'm just here as a reporter telling you that under the rules of court, there are certain things that juries can hear and certain things that juries can't hear. And when you get into an area of testimony such as law and your construction of the law, the judge will dismiss the jury, and then you can sit there and have a sidebar conference with the judge and the prosecutor, and you can talk and hash out the legal issues outside the hearing of the jury. So for practical purposes, a jury trial is irrelevant and immaterial in a tax case. So I just wanted to report that to you as a law school instructor, that in a tax case, a jury trial is for all practical purposes irrelevant and immaterial. And you'll do better trying the case as a matter of law in front of the judge if you've got a legal issue and you're saying that it's unconstitutional or that you're an exemption or an exception to the law for some reason. The judge is the guy you want to take this to in a pretrial motion, in a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment, not a jury trial. By the time this thing devolves into or degenerates into a jury trial, you've already lost. This thing is history. Because the jury, when they hear your story, especially if it's one of these 1997 losing issues over here, when they hear that, and remember, those are the two-thirds that are still paying their taxes because they're going to ask them in jury selection, are you a taxpayer? Yeah. Are you paying your taxes? You bet. So when that one-third tax protest comes in before that two-thirds that are taxpayers, boy, they don't want to hear that. And you're not going to get a non-taxpayer, a tax protester on the jury because the prosecutor isn't going to allow it. He can't get a fair shake. And, of course, you're a tax protester, and as a matter of law, you're guilty, so you can't get a fair shake. It's kind of like trying Saddam Hussein, you know, for genocide or something. You know, that guy's not going to get a fair shake. There's no way that Saddam Hussein can get a fair trial. You don't need to give the guy a trial at all. That's just for show. Everybody knows we're going to kill him when it's all over. So what the hell's all this horse-pucky about giving him a fair trial? Tax protesters don't get fair trials. You get a showcase trial. Just because it's the way we do things here in America. You know, we're going to hang you. We're going to get you, but we're going to do it, you know, in a legal fashion. We're going to give you your day in court. It's just the way we do things. Kind of like going to church, you know. You got to stand up and sing three songs, and then you got to have the morning announcements, and then you got to have the sermonette, and, you know, there's a process that you go through. The Eighth Circuit noted in Grabinski that such a ruling in no way removes from the jury fact questions regarding whether a defendant was required to file a return, actually failed to make a return, or whether a failure to file was willful. However, some courts have cautioned that such a ruling may improperly invade the province of the jury. The Sixth Circuit has held that the trial court should only properly state the law respecting the definition of a return and then leave it to the jury to decide whether the defendant had properly filed a return. The Sixth Circuit held in Saucy, that's Tupper Saucy, that the following jury instructions were proper. a document which does not contain sufficient information relating to the taxpayer's income from which the tax can be computed is not a return within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations thereunder. Whether any document submitted by the defendant constitutes tax returns is a matter for the jury to decide. Similarly, in United States versus Goetz, the 11th Circuit held that the trial court improperly invaded the province of the jury by determining that the documents filed by the defendants did not contain any financial information and concluded that, as a matter of law, these documents were not returns. So, if you want the jury to decide whether or not these are returns, most of the courts agree that the jury can decide whether or not this document that you filed constitutes a return. And remember, these are the people who file their returns, and they know what goes on it. Now tell me that's a fair trial, huh? Well, at least for tax protesters. Now, a lot of times people say, well, I want a jury of my peers. Oh, you do? You want a jury of your peer? You want a jury of taxpayers to decide your case and you haven't been filing and paying your taxes? I mean, come on, kids. Let's grow up and get real. Those are the last people that you want to judge you, a jury of your peers. Let's consider this, though. What if you were not a taxpayer? I mean, what if you didn't have a Social Security number, a taxpayer identification number, and you were out here working for just weights and balances, and you followed the law of God, you practice thou shalt not steal, you don't have unjust weights and balances, you don't use Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, or checks, you don't deal in usury or interest. I mean, this is getting kind of wild, isn't it? I know somebody's out there chomping at the bit, and he's saying to himself, how in the hell does this guy live? This guy must live in a box under a rock. Oh, no. Hell, I got a light switch over on my wall. I got electric lights here. I've got indoor plumbing, partner. I mean, I got a real toilet in my house. And I don't have Federal Reserve notes, and I have not made more than the minimum filing requirement since 1978. And if you've got any evidence that I do or did, then why don't you bring it forth? Go report it. Now, little grasshoppers, I avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. In fact, that's what God told you in the Ten Commandments. He said, you know, you boys and girls should pay attention to me. Listen up. Let me tell you how this game is played. But back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, we came to the conclusion. Now, it might not have been you, and it might not have been me, but our great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaddies, 84 generations back, came to the conclusion that the God of Abraham had his head up his rectal region and didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't understand economics. He didn't understand government. He didn't understand that the people wanted a king. You know, some guy that you could look up to and you could cheer and rant and rave over like George Bush. So we decided 84 generations ago that what we were going to do is to correct God's mistakes. And God knows he's made a bunch of them, as evidenced by the fact that he thought he could rule over us directly without a king. Can you believe that? And he thought that we didn't need Mardi Gras. He didn't put that into Leviticus 26. He didn't think we needed Christmas, Easter, and New Year's either, and he left that out. Thank God we came along and fixed that. Put Mardi Gras in, Christmas, Easter, and New Year's. And he didn't think he needed an income tax or Social Security or a Veterans Administration or a Department of Agriculture either. He never made any provisions for those kinds of institutions. Thank God that we had Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin D. Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Bill Clinton and George Bush to fix those deficiencies in our government. Thank God that we had a Franklin D. Roosevelt who could get rid of that ugly, nasty gold stuff and a Lyndon Baines Johnson who could get rid of silver coin and give us clad coin and paper money and a Federal Reserve System. God bless Woodrow Wilson. You know, little grasshoppers, if you stop and think about it, you know, you and I are the proximate cause of our own injury. You ever stop and think of that? Now, I mentioned a little earlier that that war in Iraq sounded like a real good idea when George Bush and Colin Powell went before the United Nations, and he said, that sucker over there's got weapons of mass destruction, and he's going to use them, and he's going to kill millions of people, and we got to have a regime change. That sounded real good to me. I've come to a little different conclusion. I was watching 60 Minutes last night, and this guy, John Murtha, maybe you recognize that name. He's a Democratic representative from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. He's a decorated war hero from the Korean War and Vietnam, spent 37 years in the military. He's a Marine. He says George Bush has got his head up the wrong end. In fact, he went so far as to say, you know, if that George Cheney and George Bush had ever spent any time in the military, they might know something. I thought, well, gosh, that's a wild new concept. You mean to tell me that the commander-in-chief ought to be like a General Eisenhower, you know, or a John Murtha, somebody that actually knows something about war? Well, anyway, this guy Murtha said, you know, I was all in favor of that war in Iraq. I thought it was a hell of an idea, but I came to the conclusion that I made a mistake a year ago when I said that war in Iraq was necessary and imperative, and now I've come to the opposite conclusion. It was a hell of a dumb idea, and we really got in over our heads, and now it's time for us to extricate ourselves from it. I kind of came to the same conclusion. Sounded like a hell of an idea at the time, but I've come to the conclusion that, you know, I don't think that's such a good idea anymore. Maybe we ought to start thinking about changing that policy. And the same thing is true with this king idea back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. I'm sure that was a heck of an idea back, you know, a couple, 3,000 years ago. But I think now in retrospect, little grasshoppers, you and I ought to start thinking about that. Maybe that wasn't as good an idea as it sounded at the time. Maybe God wasn't as bad of a ruler over us as we gave him credit for. You know, maybe the Ten Commandments ain't near as bad as we thought they were. And maybe tithing isn't nearly as onerous as this income tax. I often wondered about that. 10% versus 75%. I mean, if you're in the top tax brackets, and then you're paying all 14 of those taxes, sucker, you're losing 75%. Well, 74%. And you get to keep 26. I've pointed this out a time or two. If you're making $50,000 a year and paying your 14 taxes, you get to keep about $20,000. The government gets $30,000. If that ain't enough for you, then why don't you go out there and make twice as much? Work twice as hard. Produce twice as much. Make $100,000 next year. And you'll get to keep 8% of that second $50,000. And the government's going to get 42% of the second $50,000. I'm sure that income tax in 1913 sounded like a great idea. But now in the year 2005, it doesn't sound near as good to me as it did back in 1913. I think we made a mistake, boys and girls. Now, if you'd like to rectify that mistake, you know, maybe, just maybe, if you could eliminate that income, you could eliminate the income tax. It worked real well for me. When I stopped making income and I started concentrating on property, I discovered that when you deal with gold and silver coin, just weights and balances, which is, by the way, provided for in our law. Did you know that? Title 31. I don't know. I suspect that God himself must have a hand in our lawmaking process, because when you obey God and keep his commandments and practice the Mosaic law, if you look it up in the U.S. Code, you'll find that there's a provision in there that just happens to work out. Let me give you an illustration. I had a lady come by and knock on my door here about 2000, year 2000, the census year. Remember that? They take the census, you know, every 10 years, 1980, 1990, 2000. They'll be back knocking on your door here in four more years, 2010. Well, this lady knocked on my door, and she said that I'm the nice lady from the Census Bureau, and I need to get some information from you. Now, I'm a religious nut. I don't know if you knew that, but I'm a religious nut. And I didn't think that Israelites should be numbered. I thought Israelites are an odd, peculiar people that ought not to be numbered by the king. And I told her that. I said, lady, I'm not really sure that this is legal. And she assured me that this was legal. She told me it was the law that I had to be numbered. And I said, God, I didn't know that. Could you point that out to me in the law where it requires me to be numbered? And she looked at me with a blank stare. And there was this long pregnant pause. Try it sometime. You know, when somebody says it's the law, you have to have a social security number. I didn't know that. Could you tell me where in the law it says I have to have a social security number? And you'll be faced with this blank stare and this long pregnant pause. And I'm sure that you're just as persuaded as anybody else that it's the law and you have to have one. I mean, after all, you've got one. It must be the law. I mean, you're no dummy. So she said, well, I don't know. I'll have to check with my supervisor. I said, would you do that? You go back and check with your supervisor, and then you come back here and show me that law so that I can comply with it. I'd like to know what the details of that law are. She never came back. Now, I happen to know where that law is. It's in Title 13, so write this down, little grasshoppers, and check this out. See if I'm lying to you. You go to Title 13 of the U.S. Code, and then go to Section 2, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. And in Section 224D, take a look at that, 224D, Congress wrote in an exception to the census law. Now remember, the census is written right into our Constitution. I mean, the founding fathers said, you got to count these people every 10 years. And in Congress, they enacted legislation in Title 13 of the U.S. Code, Section 221, 2, 3, 4, 5, long in there. But in Section 224D, they wrote in an exception to the law. It says, if you're a religious objector, you can be accepted from the law, exempted. Did you know that? So here's God comes along and says, don't you number an Israelite. Don't you take any census over here. And I know somebody's going to say, well, in Numbers 1, there's a census. Yeah, that's right. In Numbers chapter 1, there's a census. God counted all the Israelites. God is the owner of the Israelites. God can count them. But nobody else can. Nobody else. So I'm just reporting to you those facts. So when I say to you that the Congress of the United States, President Bush, the Supreme Court of the United States are all in agreement that we ought to obey God and keep his commandments. In fact, Congress said so in Public Law 97-280, that statute 96-1211. And they said we ought to study and apply the teachings of the Scripture. Did you know that? The Supreme Court of the United States and Seeger said that there's a higher loyalty than loyalty to the United States, and that's loyalty to God. So I just thought I'd let you know that the Supreme Court and the Congress are all in favor of you obeying God and keeping His commandments. Now, if you decide that you don't want to do that for some reason, you know, God's a little dumb, He's a little stodgy, He doesn't really have His finger on the pulse of reality, and you've decided that He made some mistakes and you want to fix His mistakes, Congress comes along and says, okay, we got a program for that. If you don't think that God's tithing program is correct, we've got an income tax program. If you don't think working is a very good program, Congress comes along and says, God, we've got Social Security. So some years back, I took a look at Social Security and I said, my God, these people are taking 16% of everything that I create and produce. And then when you add that income tax to that, that's another 17%. That's a third of everything I create and produce in those two taxes. One day I woke up and I said, you know, maybe God had a pretty good program, and maybe I'll look into it. So I looked into the program that God gave to Moses out at Mount Sinai, no Social Security and no income tax. Saved me 33% right off the top. Then he came along and he said, hey, listen, why don't you use gold and silver coin, just weights and balances, and quit stealing from people, Gordon. And I thought, oh, shucks, maybe I ought to give it a try. And I did, and I got a $50 gold piece. And when I work for somebody, instead of charging that guy $500, I only charge him $50 in gold. See, I just put that in my contract. I just say, look, if you want to buy something from me, I don't want $500 from you. That's inflationary. I just want real money. Just give me $50 in gold coin. And then instead of making thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a year, I just make a few hundred dollars a year. But I make a few hundred dollars a year in gold. And I found out that a few hundred dollars in gold goes farther than many thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in fiat paper currency. And that's provided for by guess who? The Congress of the United States in Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112. I don't know who put that in there, whether it was God or it was some senator or representative. I'm just pointing out that whenever there's a law that God has given you in the Bible, there's a corresponding exemption for you to practice it in the United States Code. Test it, and you'll find out. Hey, I'm out of time again. We've got to stop right about here and give you a couple of final reminders, and we'll be back to conclude this story tomorrow night. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.